From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Neil Conan, in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, science fiction writer Werner Vinge. 20 years ago, he anticipated cyberspace in one of his novellas. His novels include A Fire Upon the Deep and A Deepness in the Sky. Vinge is also a professor of mathematics and computer science. He'll talk about space opera, artificial intelligence, and how to survive the post-human era. Also, actor Steve Buscemi. He's appeared in films like Mystery Train, Reservoir Dogs, and Fargo. He directed and produced his newest movie, Animal Factory. And linguist Jeff Nunberg on the Florida Literacy Test. It's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. 2 hours have gone by since the passing of the deadline for Florida counties to officially report their presidential votes. A state judge upheld today's deadline but left open the possibility that the Florida Secretary of State would have to accept hand counts from some counties. Judge Terry Lewis said the counties could file new vote tallies after the deadline, saying Secretary of State Catherine Harris would have to exercise proper discretion in deciding whether to approve or reject them. An unofficial tally by the Associated Press put Bush in the lead by 286 votes. The Gore campaign has decided not to appeal for now and instead urged the counties to go ahead with the hand counts. The Secretary of State is expected to begin a news conference soon to announce the results. Miami elections officials conducted a manual recount of several thousand ballots today, even as the Bush campaign escalated its fight to stop the recounts. NPR's Philip Davis has more from Miami.
The Bush campaign says it is appealing a Monday decision by a U.S. federal judge here upholding the manual recounts. The appeal will be filed with the U.S. Court of Appeals in Atlanta. The Bush campaign will reiterate its so far losing argument that the recounts violate the Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution as well as citizens' due process rights. Meanwhile, despite the legal challenge and a 5 p.m. deadline set by Florida's Republican state secretary, Miami elections officials painstakingly recounted some 3,000 ballots from three Miami precincts. The elections officials say they're confident the state of Florida will accept the amended recount, but that number has not yet been released. Philip Davis, NPR News, Miami.
Israeli opposition Likud party leader Ariel Sharon spoke today to a gathering of American Jewish leaders in Chicago. He says he'll call for early elections in order to unseat Prime Minister Ehud Barak and bring about a stable peace in the Mideast. Jason DeRose of Chicago Public Radio was there.
General Sharon spoke of what he called the gathering storm of violence in Israel today. Echoing a theme begun by Prime Minister Ehud Barak in a speech here last night, Sharon blamed Palestinian Authority Chairman Yasser Arafat for the current round of violence in the Middle East. Sharon says he's in favor of a lasting peace, but not if it leads to a weak Israel.
Peace means security to the Jewish people, not for short times, nothing to do with elections in our country or in this country. It should be peace for generations.
Sharon went on to outline his own plan for a secure peace in the Middle East. It includes an increase in Israeli security forces and cooperation with Palestinians to combat terrorism. For NPR News, I'm Jason DeRose in Chicago.
In stocks today, the Dow gained 164 points or 1.5%. This is NPR News. Pioneering broadcaster Robert Trout died today in New York. He was 91. Trout is credited with creating the role of network news anchor when he became the announcer for CBS's half-hour World News Roundup in 1938. The show was the first live radio newscast that combined reports from different parts of the world. Trout was a member of Edward R. Murrow's reporting team during the Second World War, spending part of the war years in London. Trout retired from full-time reporting in 1996, but continued to provide commentary for NPR's All Things Considered. A coalition of civil rights groups is giving low marks to the four major television networks for their representation of blacks, Latinos, Asian Americans, and Native Americans in their new fall lineup. NPR's Mondalit Del Barco reports from Los Angeles.
A year and a half after TV networks ABC, CBS, NBC, and Fox agreed to offer more ethnically diverse programming, African Americans are the only group to benefit. That according to a new report by multi-ethnic coalition monitoring primetime TV. Blacks now write, direct, and play the leads on shows like Fox's Boston Public. But aside from one starring role, Latinos are still in the background, and Asian Americans are at most just extras, according to the group. Karen Narasaki chairs the Asian Pacific American Media Coalition.
In the eyes of the networks, it seems that still Asian Americans are relatively rarely seen in New York, Boston, San Francisco, or Los Angeles.
To boost minority representation on television in front of and behind the camera, the coalition next plans to target advertisers, talent agencies, and cable networks. Mandalit Del Barco, NPR News, Los Angeles.
And I'm Corey Flintoff. This is NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, makers of all-natural vitamin E, ADM, supermarket to the world, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Neil Conan, in for Terry Gross. Science fiction is a literature of ideas, but one necessarily tied to science. Many of the great SF novels of the 1950s still work as stories, but they're almost laughably out of date in technology. Werner Vinge is both a victim and a perpetrator of this conundrum. 20 years ago, he wrote a science fiction novella called True Names that projected computers powerful enough to generate what we now call cyberspace. The net also figures prominently in his brilliant award-winning novel, A Fire on the Deep. Werner Vinge, however, is also a professor emeritus of mathematics and computer science at San Diego State University, who believes that everything he and everyone else has written will probably be out of date in the post-human era, an event he suspects will begin in about 25 years.
When you look at the advances in computers, there's one common rule of thumb that's applied to them called Moore's Law, which has various more or less precise definitions, but roughly speaking, it's that things get, for the same price, things get better with computers at about double every year and a half or 2 years. Other people have taken this and looked, tried to estimate how powerful is our thinking process as human beings. And in fact, we are enormously more powerful, in case people haven't guessed, we're enormously more powerful than any computer that was ever built. It's so laughably more powerful that, in fact, this is probably why any discussion of superhuman computers sounds so frivolous.
This is despite all the chess programs and that sort of thing.
Right. If you try to make an estimate of how computationally powerful we are as humans, it is very powerful. On the other hand, Moore's Law is doubling every year and a half or 2 years. So there have been a fair number of people who've tried to make some estimate of how swift and intelligent we are in terms of what our basic hardware is like, and come to the conclusion that if Moore's Law were to continue for another 20 years or so, that we would hit a crossover point, that we would hit a point where it would be possible to make computers as powerful as a human, assuming someone could figure out, you know, how to program them. And in fact, that's not... To me, that's amazing and wonderful and so on. It's not especially shattering because we already know how to make things as smart as people. We can do it. It takes about 9 months. But the important thing about the crossover point is what happens a year or two after that. If you got critters that were smarter than humans in significant ways, more creative, then in a way... The thing that really differentiates us from the rest of the animal kingdom, we have lost being at the top of. And the thing that makes it possible for us to predict what's going to happen technologically is our creative intelligence. Well, if the central players are actually of a greater intelligence than that, then that means after that sort of a crossover point, people who try to do prognostications, like science fiction writers,
right,
like in any sort of even a product manager types, for in a fundamental way, they are out of the loop. One analogy I use is, in the past, if you were a futurologist, you could make predictions. Like if we could have, in some magic way, bring Mark Twain into this studio this afternoon, take him outside in a weekend, he would be up to speed about our world. And I think he'd love it because he was sort of a techno freak. If you were to bring a goldfish into this studio, there's no way you could explain to it what we're doing, much less what the rest of the world is about. And to me, that would be the distinction between prognostication about technology as it has existed in the past and our trying to make prognostication about technology after this crossover point.
In a correlation, though, between your two worlds of mathematics, computer science on the one hand and science fiction on the other, Asimov's famous three laws of robotics, and that is, of course, restrictions on the robots to make sure that they don't take over.
Right. And basically, it's a hierarchy of laws, ultimately trying to ensure that although these robots would do what we want, that they won't hurt us. And these are to be built into the mechanism of these human and superhuman machines. So we're talking about stuff that nobody has ever done, and it being done in ways that we can't understand. So this is fun, but I don't claim it's in any way definitive or true. But my personal belief is that if you tried to make laws like that, ones that didn't have enough wiggle room so that a really smart robot could think around them. Mm-hmm. You might be able to do it, but it would be a very uncompetitive product. In other words, very likely the way this stuff would happen would be out of competition, military competition, economic competition, even artistic competition. And in such a situation, if you built a critter that was strictly enough regulated so it really couldn't think its way around these laws, I don't think it would be competitive against other people who would make things that were a little bit more loosely constrained.
It would also assume that if you're building in these self-protective laws, that you're intending actually to build something that is smarter than human.
Yes, and I think it's very likely that when this really happens, it will not necessarily be because of someone's proximate conscious effort to make it happen. The whole issue of human-computer interfacing, you know, keyboards, mm-hmm. mouses, all of this stuff... is really a long, long path dedicated to the same thing, making it easier for us to use these devices to get answers that we want. And so as we move into more and more easy interactions with machines, wearable computers, implantable computers, very large systems, say, that are automatically controlling highway systems and things like this, it's a slide that I don't think has any one particular moment where you can say, oh, we don't want to do that. That might be dangerous.
So it's likely to happen almost by accident.
Yes. Now, I think there are arguments for saying that it wouldn't happen. In fact, one thing has been fun for me over the years is to collect all the reasons why people say this is all impossible.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them are just sort of gut-level things about, you know, machines and people. I think that if it doesn't happen, the most likely reason, the most likely apparent reason, will be that we never figure out how to write these really big computer programs that would be necessary to do all this wonderful stuff.
Incompetence would be in our way.
Our incompetence with software complexity or the complexity of large systems. Moore's law is one thing, but if you talk to a programmer about Moore's law and about some of the things we're talking about, most of them will roll their eyes and they'll say, have you ever worked on any really large program? I suspect that in order for this stuff to work out the way I'm talking about, mm-hmm. we would have to have some fundamentally different ways of looking at creating large systems. It wouldn't be programming. It'd be more biological. And in fact, the problem has been solved. I believe the human brain has about 100 billion neurons. And each of those neurons is arguably as powerful as a computer CPU.
Mm-hmm.
And they all do work together. So there actually are working models that have solved these massive parallelism problems. That's the strongest reason to believe there's some way of doing it. I don't think it will be done by anything like what we think of as software engineering or programming.
Well, such speculation inevitably leads you into philosophical, even religious questions.
Yes. In fact, I think the analogy with the standard religious, you know, the coming of the New Age religious stuff, or as I think science fiction writer Ken MacLeod put it, the techno rapture, referring it to as techno rapture.
That's a great word.
Really, yes, it really has a psychologically the hierarchy of ideas. If you just look at what is being said about conclusions, it looks isomorphic. It looks the same shape as many of the religious transcendental event type things in the past. I think that's a valid descriptive criticism. I think there is still kind of the necessity of sitting down and looking at this case and looking at what is actually going on and deciding whether the similarity of shape is an accident or it's a mental failure of the people running around talking about the techno rapture.
But we feel intrinsically that there is something beyond simple computing power that makes us that translates to that quality of being human, that simple accumulation of computing power in a machine will never make it human.
I think that's actually the strongest internal gut criticism of the notion. For me, I think that criticism is not really valid. We have not seen really powerful machines. And furthermore, I would certainly grant that the organization of the machine and the way the different parts work with each other, talk to each other, is supremely important. If we don't do this, I think it will be because we just don't figure out how to get very large numbers of these devices to coordinate the way our brain cells coordinate with one another. But you've put your finger on kind of the internal reason why, the sort of hardwired reason within us that this whole thing looks very implausible.
Yet, if you get a machine that I guess has enough computational power to it, it'll acquire. Well, they used to say about the difference between the U.S. Air Force and the Soviet Air Force. And the U.S. Air Force had much better quality planes, but the Soviets had much more of them. And they used to argue that a quantity has a quality all its own.
There are some people who think that if we just made a computer that say had as many processors as the human brain, and did fairly routine things with it, that it would eventually quote wake up, unquote. I don't know whether that's true or not. I really sort of doubt it. I suspect that it's very likely we're going to get to the point where we make machines this large, because you look at Moore's law and you look at market forces, the demand is there for other reasons for machines to get this powerful. There are a couple things that could go wrong. We may have underestimated how powerful single neurons are. There are some people who think that single neurons are as good as the largest computer that was ever been built.
Well, that seems to just postpone the date, not
yeah, that would just
it.
Postpone it. So the more likely failure scenario would be, we make something this big and don't figure out how to make the parts talk. Probably the way, if we do succeed in doing it, it will be a matter of growing certain sorts of behaviors into it and teaching the thing, much as what happens, say, in the first 9 months of a fetus's life and then the first year or two after that, where there's an awful lot of sort of formation that occurs. There are very serious people around who believe that that's not the way it is, that it can be done very directly just with a few relatively simple rules that we haven't figured out. They are more optimistic in this direction than I am.
My guest is Werner Vinge. His most recent novel is A Deepness in the Sky. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Werner Vinge's most recent book is A Deepness in the Sky. He's our guest on Fresh Air. In that book, A Deepness in the Sky, you managed to set a book in the far future involving space-faring species that come across a first astronomical phenomenon and set the story to a large degree seemingly in the 1930s.
Yes. I did what has been done in science fiction a lot. I had this alien race. The alien race is about at the level of technology that we were in the 30s. And for me, the other fun thing about it, was that I turned the Men in Black, you know, the movie and the whole thing about UFOs.
Mm-hmm.
I turned it upside down because in this story, the humans are the UFOs. We're lurking around at the edges of this a non-human civilization, waiting, and we're waiting to take over. And we're watching these guys and watching what they're doing. And they're essentially going through a lot of the stresses that we went through in the 20th century, except in a somewhat intensified form because of their peculiar problems. So this made it easy for me to do a lot of things and play on a lot of issues that are meaningful to us and still do it realistically in the sense that it is thousands of years from now.
One of the most attractive elements, of course, to people in my business is that one of the most interesting elements of this world is a children's radio program.
Yes. The children's radio program, of course, is that this is the non-human race.
Mm-hmm.
The children of that race had this radio program. And the aliens, I mean the humans, remember the humans are the flying saucer
are
people
in
the
ETs, yeah.
Yeah, the humans are the ETs. Anyway, the humans are lurking up in space, and they're listening to this radio program because radio programs in particular are good for them because they can study the language of the non-humans, you know, just like the reverse in flying saucer stories.
Mm-hmm.
And they especially like children's radio programs because there the language is simpler, depending on, you know, the age range.
Mm-hmm.
So they had stolen a bunch of children's textbooks earlier in the story to kind of get a start, and then they listened to this children's radio program. And because of various plot stresses in the story, the humans are in a very stressful situation, and they're going to be there for a number of years, and they don't have any children, and they can't see these non-human critters who don't look very nice at all. They're not human-like.
Spiders is what they are.
Yeah, they look like large spiders. They're not, you know, really spiders, but they have that physical appearance, and so the humans are getting all really are getting wrapped up in the radio show. It has all the they have all the reasons that I just said for why they're interested in the radio show, but they also have character-driven reasons why they're interested in it. And one of the most fun but trickiest scenes of the book is I have the radio show going on, the children's radio show. The humans are listening. The humans are doing live translations for their own people, you know, like the UN, and that's being just sort of shunted through all the human space station. And there's this interaction as they're trying to figure out what's going on the ground. Then I also have the scenes on the ground sort of intermixed with how the radio show is being seen topside amongst the humans. And so there's a rather tricky interaction of motivations there that ultimately do have some connection, it turns out, rather deep and action-moving connections.
You also, your wife wrote science fiction as well.
Ah, my ex-wife.
Ah.
So we were married from 71 until 79.
This is Joan Vinge.
Right, Joan D. Vinge. And we still actually vet each other's work and you know talk about the work that each other is doing. So I'm very pleased that she continued with the name Vinge, both for personal and professional reasons.
Did you guys meet in the world of science fiction, or how did that happen?
I was an invited speaker as a science fiction writer at an English course about science fiction. It was an extension course, and she was attending it. This was like 1969, and so that's where we met. So she had been doing some. She'd already been into writing science fiction at that time. She had not sold any, It really was fun, you know. Any time two pros get to talk about the work they're working on, that is fun. And in this case, since there was also the romance angle, that was also very fun.
But a lot of science fiction writers have a lot of trouble with this little world of conventions and these awards. You know, they almost cringe at the idea of hanging out with people with Spock ears.
Oh, I think actually the science fiction convention part of society is an extraordinarily interesting thing. It is fairly large. It's large enough so that there are people who are intensely interested in particular stories and series of stories like Star Trek.
Mm-hmm.
but then also interested in other things. Overall, I don't think it has been done, but it would be very interesting for some anthropologist to do a thesis on the science fiction convention, the people who go to science fiction conventions. I am very admiring, actually, of the phenomenon of the science fiction conventions. There are situations where it brings together the most creative people in the world in a variety of fields. For instance, the World Science Fiction Convention. Remember wandering around LA Con in 1984 and just seeing what was going on. There were older people, but there were the sort of young Turks from the movie industry, from the writing industry, from the comic book industry, from the general technology industry, and even from the military. And to be able to sit down in a bar or sit or in the exhibits and be talking to people who were actually among the brightest and most creative, even if not the most recognized, is a very extraordinary thing. On balance, I think the science fiction conventions have been an enormous help to young people who have certain sorts of intense, concentrated interests in certain creative and technical fields.
Werner Vinge, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you, Neil.
Werner Vinge is a professor emeritus of mathematics and computer science at San Diego State University. His most recent novel is A Deepness in the Sky. This is Fresh Air.
My baby's gone on a trip to the moon, and she won't be back too soon. She doesn't write me and I can't sleep. All I hear from her is, my baby's up in a rocket machine. Since she left, she ain't been seen. She doesn't call me and I can't sleep. All I hear from her is, I wonder if means I miss you. Or maybe means I want to kiss you. I'm hoping that means I love you. And she's coming down to earth again. My baby's high in the stratosphere. I'm so low cause I'm down here. My love for her is gonna keep till she comes back and whispers.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From BEA, providing the WebLogic e-business platform, infrastructure software for the development and deployment of e-business applications, BEA.com. And from Random House Incorporated's Bantam Books Division, publisher of The Change Before the Change, Everything You Need to Know to Stay Healthy in the Decade Before Menopause, by Dr. Laura E. Corio and Linda G. Kahn. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, actor and director Steve Buscemi on the differences between independent and blockbuster films. Buscemi's newest movie is called Animal Factory. And Jeff Nunberg on literacy and the Palm Beach County ballot controversy. This is Fresh Air. I'm Neil Conan, in for Terry Gross. My guest, Steve Buscemi, is an actor who's appeared in more than 60 movies. He's probably best known for his work with the Coen brothers in Fargo, Barton Fink, and Miller's Crossing, and in Quentin Tarantino's Reservoir Dogs. There, he played a member of a gang. The leader assigns code names to protect the thief's identity, but Buscemi's character is unhappy with his alias.
Here are your names. Mr. Brown, Mr. White, Mr. Blonde, Mr. Blue, Mr. Orange, Mr. Pink.
Why am I Mr. Pink?
Because you're a faggot, all right?
Why can't we pick our own colors?
No way, no way. Tried it once, it doesn't work. You get four guys all fighting over who's going to be Mr. Black. But they don't know each other, so nobody wants to back down. No way. I pick. You're Mr. Pink. Be thankful you're not Mr. Yellow.
Yeah, but Mr. Brown, that's a little too close to Mr. Sh.
Mr. Pink sounds like Mr. Put. How about if I'm Mr. Purple? I mean, that sounds good to me. I'll be Mr. Purple.
You're not Mr. Purple. Some guy on some other job is Mr. Purple. You're Mr. Pink.
Who cares what your name is?
Yeah, that's easy for you to say. You're Mr. White. You have a cool-sounding name. All right, look, if it's no big deal to be Mr. Pink, you want to trade?
Steve Buscemi gives himself a small part in the new movie Animal Factory, which he directed. The film introduces us to Eastern State Penitentiary through the eyes of Ron Decker, an attractive young man who needs to learn the rules of prison life if he's to survive. He quickly learns that he will need allies, and he turns to an older convict, Earl, for protection. The film has many familiar elements: rape, murder, drugs, escape, politics, and protest. But it's driven by the unusual relationship between the two main characters. In this scene, Earl, played by Willem Dafoe, explains to Ron, played by Edward Furlong, why he's decided to help him.
Of course, if I'm to be completely truthful, I probably wouldn't help you at all if you were ugly. But that's my problem, not yours. Little I've seen tells me you're neither stupid nor weak.
I'm just not in my element in here, you know?
I know. Best way to explain this. It's a need to feel something. Something I don't get from Paul or Vito or TJ. I mean, I love those guys, but he's different. This is different. It's not about f***ing. I could have done that already if that's all I wanted. The last thing I want is for you to get a jacket as a punk. You do when you carry that wherever you go, any prison you go to, even 20 years from now. All the convict has is his name among his peers. Remember that.
It's an extraordinary performance, I think, by Willem Dafoe. He is both scary. I couldn't help but compare him to Marc Messier, the kind of that almost symbol of bald-headed toughness,
right.
But shows so much. You don't expect to see such a tender side.
Which is why I really wanted Willem to play the part, because Willem has all of that in him. You know, to look at him, I mean, he's not really a big guy, but he's...
He can carry himself as big.
He does, and he looks menacing. And he, you know, certainly looks like he could command the respect of the other convicts in the prison yard. And yet he also has the intelligence and the sensitivity that was required of the character as well.
The prison itself is almost a character. When you went looking for a location, what were you looking for?
Well, the book takes place in San Quentin, which has the, you know, the classic five tiers. So we were looking for a place like that, but it's hard to find. I mean, I knew that I didn't want to shoot in a real prison because you're at the mercy of their schedule. And a
little inflexible at times.
Yes. And then somebody told me about this place in Philadelphia, Eastern State Penitentiary, which is the first penitentiary that was built in the United States by the Quakers in, I think, the early 1800s. And we went and we looked at it, and It's a great place, but it's now a museum, and you can shoot there, but you can't change anything. And so the place was just a little bit too, looked too run down to be a working prison. But they said that there's one that looks exactly like it, that was designed the same way a few miles away in Holmesburg. And this had been vacant for about 5 years, so it was in much better shape. And they told us that we could do anything we wanted to do it. So that became our location. And I fell in love with the look of it because it's a very unusual place. It's designed like a wagon wheel, and the main guard center is in the center of the facility. And all the cell blocks, which are just single house cell blocks, are like spokes off the main hub, and surrounded by a 30-foot stone wall.
There are some extraordinarily vivid characters, including two played by Mickey Rourke, Jan the actress, and Tom right. Arnold, who is really menacing.
Right. Yeah, we were really fortunate to get both of them in the film. Mickey I had worked with before, so we knew each other a little bit, and I knew that he was interested in working with me. I think he was a little surprised when we offered him this part, but once he committed, he was just amazing. I mean, he practically showed up dressed the way that he is in the film. I mean, he brought his own wardrobe, did his own nails, and even wrote a monologue that I used in the film about becoming, you know, wishing he was a butterfly and flying out through the bars and flying to Paris, which I found really moving. And I only had him for a day and a half, so I didn't have a lot of time to work with him, but I think I used just about almost every frame that I shot of him. And he was so much fun to work with and to watch. And Tom Arnold, I didn't know, but we have the same agent. And my agent said that he too was interested in working with me. And was there anything in the film? And I thought, well, if I'm, you know, and that idea intrigued me because he is such a character, Tom.
Mm-hmm.
And even in his comedy, you know, to me, there's a sense of, you know, anger that lurks beneath it. And, you know, and he definitely has an edge. And I wanted to see him do something, you know, really different from what we're used to seeing.
You're a character actor of no small reputation yourself. And yet you give yourself a role in this film, which, excuse me if I characterize it as a somewhat gray role as a prison official. Why didn't you take one of the really meaty ones?
Well, I wasn't so interested in being in the film, but my financer said that if I did take a role, that my name would mean something in securing the financing. So I gave myself a small part, and it was tough because I didn't want to play a convict. I feel like I've done that before. I didn't want to play a guard because in a uniform I look like Barney Fife, and so I wasn't sure what to do. And I saw this role of this prison official, and I thought, well, I get to wear a shirt and tie, and you know, sort of act like a director, you know, too, in the film. And I just thought that would be the best role for me, and I enjoyed playing it as well.
But the suggestion came from the financial side. Are you telling us that you're a bankable name now?
I'm not I mean, if I, you know, said to them that I was the lead in the film, I don't think that would have worked. But because I had Willem and Eddie Furlong and Mickey Rourke, you know, they said, well, you know, that I mean, actually, I think my name means more in Europe and other foreign territories than it does here. And you know, that's one of the ways that the financer is able to finance the film. They pre-sell it in Europe. And, you know, it just comes down to who's in it. You know, what does the poster look like? And how many names are on the poster? And unfortunately, I mean, this is how lots of films get made.
And if it means taking a part, I guess that's no great sacrifice.
It was easier for me to take a part than to ask, you know, a famous friend of mine, you know, to say, can you just come in and do this for me? It was, you know, I mean, I wasn't, you know, that opposed to taking a part. I mean, it's something that I did in Trees Lounge, and this seemed like
Trees Lounge was the first feature that you directed.
Was the first film I directed, which I was one of the leads. So, I mean, that was exhausting. But in this, I knew that I would only have to work a few days, and so it didn't seem like it would take, my energies away too much from the directing side.
My guest is actor-director Steve Buscemi. His latest film is Animal Factory. We'll be back in a few moments. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Steve Buscemi, who's graced dozens of movies over the past 15 years or so and has just directed his second picture, Animal Factory. You grew up in and around New York City. Did you start out to be an actor?
Yeah. I mean, it wasn't until my senior year in high school that I started doing the school plays. Before that, it was something that I had always, you know, sort of dreamed about and fantasized about, but was too shy to really do in high school. But by the time I was a senior, I didn't care what anybody thought, and I said, you know, now I'm going to do it. And my plan was to somehow get to L.A., because I thought, you know, if you wanted to be an actor, you had to be in Hollywood. This is when I was 18, and I was living in Long Island. And it was my dad who said, look, if you really want to do this, then you should go to an acting school, and there's plenty of good schools in New York. So I checked out some and ended up going to the Lee Strasberg School for a six-month period, and then studying with John Strasberg and Sabra Jones.
At the same time, though, weren't you working as a firefighter?
Well, that came a little bit later. I had taken the test for the fire department when I turned 18, while I was living in Long Island, and then I had since moved to Manhattan, and it was about 4 years later that my name finally came up on the list. I was also still doing theater.
Back to firefighting, everybody knows that's not an easy job. It's a dangerous job. Did you enjoy it?
Yeah, I did. I mostly liked working with the guys that I was working with. My first year on the job, I decided that I should, you know, really devote my energies into learning this job. And so I stopped doing the comedy. I was not taking acting classes, and I didn't tell anybody in the firehouse that I had any aspirations of being anything. You know, and I was just like the quietest guy in the firehouse. And there was another firefighter named Dean Tulipane who worked at another house, who I had heard about, who was an actor. And after about 8 months of being on the job, I finally met him. And I was living in the East Village. He was living on McDougal Street. And he totally busted me. He said, you know, why do you live in the East Village? What do you do? What are you, a painter, actor, musician, what? You know,
had to be something.
Had to be something, because most, you know, I mean, the rest of these guys lived in Long Island or Staten Island. And so I told him, and, you know, the guys from my house looked at me astonished. And after that, they sort of forced me to perform at the firemen parties. So I kind of got back into doing stand-up that way. And then I met a couple of actors, Mark Boone Jr., who was in Trees Lounge. He's also in an Animal Factory. Boone and I started working together. We didn't do stand-up, but we wrote and performed our own one-act plays, eventually did some full-length plays, and that's really how I learned not only to be a better actor, but it's where I learned to write as well.
When did you get into movies?
That came towards my fourth year on the fire department. just from doing, you know, a lot of stage work, some filmmakers would come to check out our shows. And it was when I was doing Parting Glances. I was also doing a play with John Jezerin, who was a writer who is a playwright director that I've worked with a lot. I was doing his play called Red House. I was doing Parting Glances and still trying to make it to the firehouse, and I was, you know, about ready to collapse. So something had to go. So I took a leave of absence from the fire department, and I just never ended. I just never went back.
Been a long leave.
Took a very long leave, yes.
My guest is Steve Buscemi, the actor-director. His new film is Animal Factory. One of the possibilities that opened up to you when you were in an independent movie was one that seems most unlikely. You got a chance to sing in the movie The Imposters. We're going to play a clip from that movie now. You play a guy who's a suicidal lounge singer by the name of Happy Frank. And
Happy Franks.
Happy Franks. Yeah. And you're just about to go on stage, and it's getting a little emotional for you. Here's the clip.
It's not the pale moon that excites me, that thrills and delights me. Oh no, it's just the nearness of you. When you're in my arms and I feel you so close to me, all my wildest dreams come true. I need no soft lights.
Shortly afterwards, Happy Franks goes sobbing off the stage. When you were growing up and fantasizing as a kid about being a movie actor, did you ever think in your wildest dreams you would see yourself up on the big screen singing?
No. but it was certainly a lot of fun, and I do like to sing. Mark Boone and I used to have... used to have a band, and I used to sing in this sort of, I won't call it a joke band, because we did write songs and we had real musicians and we got real gigs, you know, but it was sort of grew out of a theater piece that we did where we played two guys in a band, and our band was called the Pawns of Love, and it was sort of described as psychedelic country music, and so, I mean, I do like to sing, and I was really happy that Stanley gave me that opportunity.
Was there a time when you made your first couple of movies that you, did you buy a ticket and go in and watch yourself on screen?
Yeah. I mean, I remember doing that for Parting Glances. I think the last time I did it was with Adam Sandler. He hadn't seen Reservoir Dogs, and we were in L.A., and it was showing, there was a midnight showing of it, and he convinced me to go along with him and a few of his buddies, and he said it was the only way that he would see it, as if I went with him. So we went, and it was, you know, and it was fun, because I don't, you know, really get a chance to see films with, you know, sort of a regular audience. I mean, I see my films either at special screenings or in a film festival, where it's, you know, you're getting real film lovers at a film festival. But just to see it with a regular general audience is nice.
When you look at yourself, I mean, are you agonized just criticizing all your mistakes, or swept away by the fact that that's you up there?
You know, I'm sort of used to it, but I still cringe every once in a while. I still... I'm amazed at how crooked my teeth are, because for some reason, when I look in the mirror, they don't seem that crooked. When I see myself on screen, it looks worse than I could ever imagine it. So there are those things. But But I mean, I'm fairly used to it.
Your dentist
plus
hasn't.
From my dentist, hasn't. I have had a lot of dentists try to straighten these teeth out, and I say you're going to kill my livelihood if you do that. So,
we wish you good luck.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Actor-director Steve Buscemi, his new movie is Animal Factory. Up next, the butterfly ballot and the terminology of the Florida recount. This is Fresh Air. The confusion over Palm Beach County's butterfly ballot has linguist Jeff Nunberg thinking about graphic literacy in the computer age.
Who'd have figured a week ago that the whole nation would be locked in a debate about literacy requirements? I'm not thinking of those literacy tests that southern states used to use, where the registrar would selectively require African Americans to answer questions about obscure points of constitutional law. Congress tossed those out with the Voting Rights Acts of the 1960s. But the Palm Beach County ballot was a new kind of literacy test, if an inadvertent one. In this case, of course, opinions tend to follow party lines. Democrats have been depicting the Palm Beach ballot as a kind of Chinese maze. One cartoonist published an official Florida ballot that showed Bush's name connected by a straight, short arrow to one hole, while the arrows after Gore, Nader, and Buchanan's names were tangled up so you couldn't tell which was which. Whereas Republicans were putting the blame on voters who were simply too dim to punch the right hole. A demonstrator in Tallahassee was carrying a sign that read, "If you can read this, you must be a Republican." And a cartoonist did a version of the Palm Beach ballot that replaced Buchanan's name with a declaration next to the punch hole that read, "I am clearly too stupid to be included in the process of electing a president." Politics aside, the debate isn't really that different from a conversation that's repeated a couple of million times a day, every time somebody calls a 1-800 hotline for help in installing a printer driver or filling out a benefits form. The people at the help desk may be more polite about it than those Republicans have been, but they usually manage to convey the same kind of message. You're clearly too stupid to be included in the process of installing a printer. In the old days, we thought of literacy as a purely verbal skill. That was implicit in the school curriculum, which was anchored in the assumption that you could master all of the linguistic skills you needed to function as a member of modern society in the course of learning to write a 3-paragraph book report. Teachers spent a week on pie charts and bar graphs, but apart from that, they never delved into the higher mysteries of document layout. But then in those days, it didn't matter as much. Most documents were a lot simpler. And the more complicated ones were usually designed by professionals, people who knew their way around all those exotic features like fonts, faces, columns, tables, and the rest. It was a more innocent age when terms like line letting and page break were as recondite as hanging Chad was before last weekend. But the world has acquired a lot more complicated interface since then. It started with the punch cards and the standardized tests of the 50s, and by now we've reached the point where you have to negotiate an elaborate graphical interface every time you want to buy gas or a bus ticket or take money out of the bank, with a microchip on the other end that's not in a position to make allowances. And the new forms of electronic documents add another level. In place of the bare text that came out of a typewriter, now we have to navigate desktop publications, PowerPoint slides, and web pages, most of them created by people who know as much about designing a page as they do about drawing a horse. Nowadays, anybody's free to explore the uncharted frontiers of typographic design, and that's pretty much what anybody's been doing. Think of the unfortunate Teresa Lepore, the Palm Beach County Supervisor of Elections. According to press reports, she was simply trying to help out older voters by increasing the font size on the ballots, using templates from some 12-year-old MS-DOS software. And then when the text got too big for one column, she started moving things around to make it fit. That's the emblematic predicament of the postmodern writer. It's one thing to compose a coherent text and another to get it to print out right. And it's no wonder readers are so often led astray these days, particularly if they're operating from a trusting nature that's left over from an age when you could assume that typographers knew what they were doing. One of the most poignant things about accounts of illiteracy is just how scary the world can be when every sign and piece of paper seems an incomprehensible obstacle. That's the same way a lot of people feel in the face of all these new interfaces and documents. Age has something to do with it, of course, but you can find a lot of young people who have this feeling of anxiety tinged with shame. I suspect that that's one thing behind the obvious distress that many of those Palm Beach voters felt when they discovered they'd voted for Pat Buchanan. And it may explain why a lot of them didn't ask for another ballot, the same way illiterates don't like to admit that they have trouble reading. I heard somebody on CNN say, well, soon we'll all be voting on the internet and we won't have these problems. I'll grant you there's something to be said for any solution that would send the word Chad back to the obscurity it deserves. Still, I have my doubts about online voting. I'm not thinking just about the security problems or the unfair advantage it gives to people who have internet hookups in their homes. But what's going to happen when every county has a different Teresa Lepore putting up its ballot on a web page with all the opportunities for confusion and misdirection that the technology affords? It's hard to see how the process won't disenfranchise even more of those people who are slow off the typographic mark. Only this time around, it'll be even worse. You'll log in to vote and click on what looks like the right button, and then a minute later, you'll suddenly realize that you've just bid on a fondue set at eBay.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist at Stanford University and the Xerox Palo Alto Research Center. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, and Monique Nazareth, with Patty Leswing and Megan Howell. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Anne-Marie Baldonado directed the show. Terry Gross is back tomorrow. Thanks for listening. I'm Neil Conan.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Wilmington Trust, recognizing worth in individuals and in unique programs like Fresh Air. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, more about the presidential election. We'll talk about the legal issues surrounding the recounts with Professor Cass Sunstein of the University of Chicago Law School. Join us for the next Fresh Air.